For members only, Golf Smarter number 266, published on January 18, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The 15 Gates of Golf, Part 2 with Jim Waldron.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Jim, welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, this one for members only.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be here.
Okay, previously on Golf Smarter. You know, if you were part of this conversation before, you know what's going on. Jim and I are just, Jim's got this book that he's not written yet. He's not completed. But we're talking about the 15 gates and how to unlock them. The 15 gates of golf and how to unlock them. So let's just pick up where we left off, all right?
Well, we were talking about, when I do these playing lessons, how I have these sort of smacking, I call them smacking the forehead moments with my open palm because I get exasperated.
What's the matter with you?
What's the matter with you? How could you not know this? You've been playing golf for 30 years. You don't know this? That's a rule. Every good player knows you shouldn't do X or Y or Z, whatever it is. But we were talking about not knowing how average golfers really don't know how far they actually hit every club in their bag. And every good player does know within a range of around 10 to 12 yards. They have a good miss minimum, an average solid strike average distance, and a pure strike where you hit it just perfect. And they know what those three distances are with every club in the bag, and they know how to take off or add more than the average distance with every club in the bag on purpose by either speeding up their body, the unwinding of their body pivot, the turning motion of your body on the forward swing, or by turning faster than normal or turning a little bit slower than normal, right? And that's just the way it is. And again, when most of my average golfers do not know this, and so they just haven't taken the time to test on the range how far their clubs actually go. Now, obviously, when you do the testing, any shot you hit really bad, a bad miss, you discount those. You don't count those, right?
Right.
You count your good miss, your average solid strike, and your pure strike. And by the way, when you practice on the range, even if you practice with brand new range balls, not old, worn out range balls, most range balls are going to go around 10% shorter than a good brand new top end golf ball like a Pro V1 will go in terms of carry distance. So you got to allow for that. Range balls go shorter than a good ball you're going to play with. So you got to factor that in.
It's almost like Olympic scoring. You got 10 judges, you throw out the high score and the low score, and then you average the rest.
Yeah, yeah, here it does two things. First of all, obviously, it gives you a much better probability of actually hitting the shot the required distance, but it also gives you confidence because you know that there's a strong probability you're going to hit the shot around. I used my own 7-iron distances. For me, it's 157 is my average 7-iron. My pure shot is 162, and my good miss is 150. Now I got a range. I know even if I screw it up, hit a good miss, which happens, like I said, I think about 2 out of 10 times I'll hit a good miss, and about 2 out of 10 times I'll pure it, and 6 out of 10 times I'll hit it my average, medium quality solid strike. So it frees you up. You have confidence because you know within that minimum maximum range, the ball is going to go most of the time that distance. So it helps your confidence. And when you're confident, you make a better swing.
Yes. I'm going to let you go. I'm fine.
What I forgot to mention? How I came up with this gate idea. The gate, and I have a background. I started studying Asian martial arts and Eastern philosophy, particularly Zen Buddhism when I was a kid. And, and there's this idea, if you read about Asian martial arts, they often talk about a gate. And in the Asian martial arts system, a gate is a dual purpose. It's in the early stages of the process of walking a journey or a path to mastery of a martial art. A gate is an obstacle to further progress. So you're sitting there and you're on the road, and there's this, all of a sudden this gate appears and blocks your progress. You try to go around either side, you can't get around it. It's impossible. You don't know how to open the door. So you've got to go through a struggle, an internal struggle, to get that door to open. And you could say the struggle is the process of learning and training. right? Mm-hmm. But eventually you find the answer, you find the key, and you unlock the door. And now the door opens, and now it's a gateway to further progress. So that's sort of a basic aspect of learning when you're walking a path of mastery. And that's how I came up with the idea. So partly because so many of my average golfer students don't know this, and they sort of had this attitude, again, an unquestioned premise that, well, okay, you know, I've been successful in my career and I make a lot of money and I'm a good husband, I'm a good father, and life has been fairly easy for me. Not that there haven't been some struggles, there have been, but for the most part, if I put my effort into something, I can fix this problem, I can solve this problem, whether it's at work or at home. But I hear this all the time, Fred, from people. But these are really successful people. I've literally had hundreds of people in the last 20 years tell me this. But for some reason, Jim, golf is a mystery to me. I cannot fathom how to get good at this game.
So true.
Biggest failure in my life is my golf game.
Everything else, God, that's so true.
But I cannot understand why is golf, of all the things I've done in my life, the one thing that I just can't get my hands around. And so that's part of this whole idea of the gate. And, of course, the first gate is all about the path of mastery. That's the first gate. You have to understand it's supposed to be hard.
That's right? Why we do it, yeah.
That's why we do it. It's not – I always tell people, well, did you play tic-tac-toe when you were, like, you know, 6 years old? Yeah. Did you play tic-tac-toe when you were 8 years old? No. Why? Because after a while, it got to be a so-called Mexican standoff. I mean, after a while, you figure out how to do it, and it just becomes a stalemate. It becomes easy.
Do you remember the movie A League of Their Own?
Oh, yeah, sure.
With Tom Hanks about the Women's Professional Baseball League.
And Madonna, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Rosie O'Donnell.
Right.
There's Rosie a O'Donnell. Scene in there where one of the girls are crying because it's so hard, because baseball's so hard. And Tom Hanks says to her, of course it's hard. That's why we love the game. The hard is what makes it great.
Exactly. That's exactly the point.
Yeah. And I actually have always loved that line and loved that quote. And at one point on my Facebook page, I put that quote, the heart is what makes it great, on my Facebook page, and my son said, you better remove that because that sounds really disgusting.
Well, that's good.
And it's like, oops, I like that. I didn't see it that way. I was referring to the movie. He goes, yeah, well, I wasn't, so get rid of it.
Yeah, the old embarrass your kid phenomenon on Facebook. Yeah.
On a daily basis, yeah. So,
He befriended you, right?
He still won't let me see his pictures. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is the struggle with golf. This is why we continue to play. This is why we listen to programs like Golf Smarter, where it's like, I just can't get enough of it, but I can't beat it. Author that we had, he was about to write this book and he was talking to some friends about it, and someone who doesn't even play golf said to him, well, I know why you play golf, because you're competing against yourself and you can never win.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And he's like, okay, I have my book. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right.
You know, there's a Japanese amazing. Term for this called Kaizen, which is basically means walking the path of mastery.
Right.
And so, you know, the point is, it sounds like a cliche, but it happens to be a fundamental truth, which is it's not the end result. It's the journey. If you're really a golfer, not what I call a flogger, but if you're really a golfer, it's the joy you get and the meaning you get from walking the path of mastery. When you have a learning breakthrough or learning light bulb, it feels so good. It's inherently worthwhile to be engaged in that process. When you break through to a higher level of scoring, same thing. When you win a tournament for the first time, same thing. When you break 80 for the first time, right? Same thing. When you can learn to hit a driver 20 yards further off the tee consistently, huge breakthrough.
So you mean it's not the ball?
No, it's not the driver.
I mean, the driver will do it if you go from a wooden head driver to the big head driver. Yeah, you'll get more yardage, but really, getting more distance. Why people think if they change golf balls, they're going to get more distance is hilarious to me. But it's not. It's really about your. It's about you.
For the most part.
Yeah.
It's about you. Yeah. So anyhow, that's. Clearing up that all those misconceptions about what the true nature of golf is the first gate. The second is basically a very condensed version of what's going to be a much longer book years from now on peak performance psychology for golf. And the main thing there is understanding what the term awareness means and what I call awareness of awareness. And, you know, I had a big breakthrough teaching about two summers ago. Again, trying to figure out why does student A, I mentioned this in my email, why do you got two guys, same handicap, that come to our golf school? Student A gets it really quickly for most of the drills and most segments of the school, and he's able to actually physically do a better golf swing within a few minutes. And student B, same athletic ability as student A, same starting handicap level at the beginning of the school, will typically struggle. And I asked myself, why do some people struggle with this stuff that I'm teaching? Other people get it right away. And so I found some answers. And the biggest thing, the number one thing on the list, is what I call awareness of awareness. And what that means is it means having the ability – well, it means two things. It means having the ability to choose where to put your mind when you're engaged in learning or training in golf and to know that it's that you've done so. In other words, if you were shining a flashlight in a dark room, if you turned a flashlight on in a dark room, and I said, shine it over there. And you shined it, you know, wherever your eyes were happen to be focusing, happen to be facing. So you shined it in front of you, and you see there's a TV set in the corner of the room, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's two kinds of awareness of that light shining on the TV set. There's a very vague, cloudy kind of awareness, which sort of acknowledges, okay, it looks kind of like a TV set. But you're really not there. And then there's the kind of awareness is like someone just poured a bucket of cold water over you and this TV set is crystal clear. And you go, hey, that's a TV set and that's my light shining on that TV set. And it's brown and it's got six knobs and it's got this size and shape. So there's a very crystal clear, highly refined sense of awareness where you start noticing things. And there's a very dull, cloudy kind of awareness where you don't notice virtually nothing. And my students who get golf fairly quickly have that type of awareness that they know they're shining a light on a TV set and they know everything about that TV set. That's the difference. Because when I ask student B, the guy who's struggling, I go, okay, we were supposed to focus on maintaining your grip pressure. That was the drill, for example. It's the same grip pressure you started with throughout the swing from start to finish, right? Now, it sounds easy on paper, so to speak. It's not easy to do, right, for most people. And the reason why it's not easy, A, they're either not putting their mind through what I call feel channel, meaning feeling the amount of pressure in your fingers, as opposed to, say, seeing a picture of your hands, which would be visual channel, or talking about it to yourself, saying the term, okay, grip pressure, grip pressure, grip pressure, which is auditory or verbal channel. Both those channels have to do with using symbols because you're seeing a picture of your hands in the case of the visual channel, or you're hearing yourself repeat a word, which is a symbol, in the auditory channel. If you get out of those two channels, which are symbol-based, and go directly into direct perception of how tightly your fingers are squeezing the handle, that's step one. But that's not enough. Student B maybe is in field channel like he's supposed to be at the beginning of the swing, but as soon as he starts his takeaway, his mind wanders off somewhere else. He's literally forgot to focus on his grip pressure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas student A can put his mind in his hands in field channel and keep it there all the way through the takeaway, all the way through the second half of backswing, all the way through transition, all the way through impact, especially where it's really hard for most people to do it, all the way to follow through, all the way to the finish, with no gaps in his or her awareness, meaning it's seamless awareness of grip pressure. Now, eventually, if student B keeps doing it enough, and if I keep getting in his face and saying, okay, where was your mind in that last swing? Well, it started out in my hands on my grip pressure, and when I got toward the top of my backswing, I happened to notice the ball, and I got a very strong impulse to throw the club head at the ball, which, of course, is what we call the hit impulse, very common flaw. And I'll go, okay, that's great. That means he's starting to get some awareness of awareness. He's aware that his awareness drifted off the hands, which is where he was supposed to put it, and went somewhere else, right?
So that's so actually good. Hard. That's so hard.
Right?
Yeah.
But that's a lipo. For someone who's been suffering from an unconscious hit impulse, now the hit impulse, there's some awareness of it. Now, eventually, that same person, maybe 20 minutes later, if I'll ask him for a report, he'll say, oh, my God, Jim, while you were away working with these other students, the last 5 minutes, I hit like, you know, 10 shots in a row with my 7-iron that went 15 yards further than I've ever hit a 7-iron in my life. And they all went directly to the target. And every single swing, I was aware that my hands – I was aware of my awareness on my hands from start to finish with no gaps. And typically they'll say something like, that's the biggest light bulb I've ever had in 30 years of playing golf.
And does that awareness seem to dissipate once they're away from their instructor? Do you know what I'm saying on that?
I would say, you got to remember, we're doing these all day, 8 hour a day, like boot
camp.
Yeah.
Right,
I'm like drill instructor.
Right, and that's one of the things that makes me crazy about golf schools is you have this intense education, intense instruction for days, and then by the end of the 2, 3, 4, 5 days, whatever you're doing there, it's starting to make sense. It's like all coming together. And then you go home and you start playing and bad habits start falling in and you forget what they were teaching you. And then it's like,
Yeah. But you know what the answer to that is? There is no solution. That's the nature of the human being.
And that's why we play
unless
golf.
Unless you're an enlightened being, I know I'm not. And I kind of doubt you are.
That's true.
Right? How many enlightened beings? I mean, I've only met two in my life. One was Krishnamurti. You might have heard of Krishnamurti. He was popular back in the 60s and 70s, lived in Southern California, Ojai. But this is actually part of one of the gates, what you just brought up, which is that we don't have continuity of consciousness unless you're an enlightened being, meaning we all have multiple personality disorder, all of us. So the golfer
that's
who had
– That's a scary thought.
It is. In fact, you know, when I was 12 years old, a neighbor gave me a book called Search for the Miraculous by a Russian author named P.D. Uspensky. And he was a disciple of a well-known spiritual teacher who was actually from the Ukraine, from Georgia. And Georgia meaning, you know, Europe, Georgia, not Georgia.
Russia.
Southern
Russia.
U.S., yeah. And his name was Georges Gurdjieff. And you know, there are study groups all over the world to study this guy's teachings even today. And this book, he had a drawing. It was a circle, and the circle had crisscross lines, you know, covering the circle. So where they intersected was a little square, and in each little square there was the letter I, like a capital I. And he said, "Man is a machine, and the machine is composed of many, many, many subpersonalities or selves. For example." And he said, and the average person, when they wake up in the morning, get out of bed, they're still dreaming. They're not fully awake. They're still in a dream state. Now, it's not the same intensity of a dream state as when you're obviously lying there asleep. But he said, you're not fully awake when you wake up. And when you go out throughout the day, various of these personalities sort of occupy or take control over your body and your mind. And so, for example, he gave the example, let's say you decide you're going to get up in the morning and you're going to do your stretching for half an hour. And you decide this the night before because you're really into this disciplined lifestyle. You think it'd be good for you to do yoga every morning for half an hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to do it. You set the alarm for 7 o'clock, and you get up and you know use the bathroom, do whatever your morning toilet routine is. And at 7:10, you're supposed to start 30 minutes of yoga, right?
Mm-hmm.
7:09, the phone rings, mm-hmm. and a friend you haven't talked to in a long time is on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Hour later, you're still talking on the phone. Right. And now it's 8:09. You get off the phone. You go, hey, I'm kind of hungry. I think I'll have breakfast. And the day goes by. No yoga.
Yep.
No stretching. You forget. People forget what their intention is. And what the job of a teacher is to continually remind the student what your original intention was. Now, eventually what will happen is you'll become less multiple personality as you walk this path of mastery. You'll become more awake than you were before you start walking the path. But there'll always be some slippage back. That's the nature of the beast. There's no quick answer to that.
So how do we get it back if once we step away?
You have to remember. You have to remember. I mean, you have to have the intention so strong. In this case, since we're talking about getting better at golf, although you could apply this to anything, if your passion is strong enough, there'll be an unconscious program running all the time in the background that says, time to wake up. Time to wake up in terms of what your intention is for golf. So, that sort of drives your – that's where commitment comes from, to get better. You have to have the passion. Mm-hmm. Now, if you don't have the passion, you're probably not going to get very good at golf. Let's face it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you don't have the passion, you're not on the path of mastery. If you're just playing golf only for external goals like lower scores, then by definition, you're not on the path. But if you have the bug, if you really love golf for all the really important, you know, true and good reasons, there'll be that little program running in the background that says, time to wake up, time to remember, time to practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember what happened in the golf school? Oh, yeah, I kept my mind in my hands for 5 minutes for 10 shots in a row. What did that feel like? Oh, it felt like X. What did it sound like at impact? Oh, it had a real clear sound to it. What did it look like? Oh, it went 150 yards in the air with a little 2-yard draw. What did it feel like in your body at the finish? Oh, yeah, I felt real balance at the finish. So what a good teacher does, whether they know it or not, some people it's conscious, some people it's not, they're trying to wake their student up to have more higher and higher levels of awareness, because that the only thing that can keep you moving forward on this path is continual awareness, more expansion of awareness. So it's a second gate. It's a pretty big one.
Very big. Absolutely. That's the second gate.
Right.
And there's 15?
Yep.
Okay.
The third gate is about how it's the psychology of effective learning. Not practicing, they're different. Learning. How do you have a learning insight, a learning breakthrough? And basically, there's two rules there. One is, these sound obvious to most serious golfers, but not everybody will get this. You have to show up to the learning environment, whether you're working with a teacher or whether you're about to read a golf book for the first time or look at a DVD, with a completely open, inquiring mind. You can't show up there with a huge number of perceptual filters blocking your view of what you're about to experience.
Explain perceptual filters.
Well, we all have perceptual filters. Some are a result of our life experience, and some are stuff we got unconsciously from our parents, from our religion growing up, from the whole society around us. So we tend to have, you know, it's a form of cultural indoctrination. So we have these perceptual filters.
How do you get rid of that? I mean, you're saying these things that you have from your life and you're born with it. How do you remove that from your process?
Well, again, even though Uspensky and Gurdjieff say we're machines, they also say we have the potential to wake up. So you also have something called free will and choice. You can choose to at least temporarily suspend your known perceptual filter. Now, again, there are perceptual filters that are so unconscious that until you do a lot of spiritual practice type of work, you wouldn't even know you have those. But the ones that you kind of know you have, your sort of known biases, you just put them aside. You say, okay, if you go to a golf, I tell my students when they come to our golf school, I go, for the next 3 days, drop everything you think you know about the golf swing for the next 3 days. Not that it may not be correct. It may be correct, but, you know, it doesn't matter. For the next 3 days, drop everything that you've ever thought about the golf swing as far as a belief about it being true or false. Just drop it for 3 days. Keep an open mind and see what happens. Because I said 3 days from now, when we're finished, if you don't like what I'm teaching you, you can go back. You're not going to forget your old beliefs. You can go back and re-embrace those old beliefs, right? So that's what I'm talking about. It's choosing to keep your mind as open as you can possibly keep it.
Wow.
Be open to hearing a new version of events, right?
Yeah.
That's the first rule. And the second rule is you have to be willing to change. It's not just temporary suspension of belief. Well, that's the first step. You have to be willing to go into a learning environment with the commitment. This is more of an emotional thing to change. Because if you're not willing to change, why are you there?
Right.
And it's a huge, huge problem. This is something your golf teacher will not want to tell you.
Well,
say to each other when they're together having a beer.
Yeah, right. I mean, I know from my own personal experience in talking to people that they'll go to a golf school to not change.
Yeah.
Like the first thing is, I want to become more consistent. And the teacher's like, all right, well, I'm looking at your swing, and you know what? We need to start you from scratch. We need to get rid of everything that's in your mind and start you from scratch. And, you know, they're like, well, no, that's not what I want. I just want to get more consistent. I want to put together my long game, my short game, and my putting so that, you know, but I don't want you to change anything.
Yeah, obviously that's insane. That's an insane on the face of its strategy. Now, it is possible to be sane and only want a little bit of change. The point is to decide ahead of time how much change do you want and then communicate that to your teacher. So if you want just a little bit of change, don't go to a boot camp golf school.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Go to a school that says we're going to work on maybe three of your easily fixable swing flaws. The only problem with that approach, though, is it doesn't always work. It tends to be temporary improvement. That's
right.
The problem.
It's a Band-Aid approach.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying it never works. Sometimes Band-Aids do work.
Sure.
And sometimes they last forever.
Do they stop the bleeding? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
On an immediate basis.
Exactly. So if you only want a little bit of change, and remember, it's not just in terms of time or in terms of depth of intensity of change. It's how consistent will the change be? And by definition, if you're asking for a little bit of change to your technique, whether it's putting stroke technique, short game technique, full swing technique, or even a little bit of change to how you approach the mental game, to your thinking about the mental game. If you're asking for a little bit of change, don't expect a high level of consistency. Expect a low level of consistency.
Right.
Because the two go together, right?
Well, and then people walk away, and again, I've heard this, people walk away from these golf schools going, he completely screwed up my game. I went downhill for the next 6 months. It was the worst thing I ever did. Because, again, they want Band-Aids.
Right.
I think so many people just want Band-Aids, and they're not willing to walk into this with an open mind to say, okay, I need to retool everything. I need to start from scratch.
Yeah, and again, not everybody needs to do that. I mean, it depends on the handicap of the player. I get this all the time. I get these guys, the new students, who are 35 handicaps, been playing golf for 20 years, are still 35. How long have you been at 35? 29 and a half years. not too good.
I'm
right?
Sorry to be laughing.
This is true. I'm not. This is absolutely true. Every teacher will tell you this. And then they'll say, but I want to be, like you said, I want to be more consistent. Well, okay, if you really want to be consistent, define it. Okay, I want to hit, right now I'm hitting three fairways around with three out of 14 fairways with my driver. All right, so define consistent. Well, I'd like to hit 10 fairways. I go, okay, if you want to hit 10 fairways, you have to learn a fundamentally sound golf swing. That's going to take you between 1 to 2 years of work and a lot of lessons, a lot of instruction. Are you willing to put 1 to 2 years of practice and a lot of training time? Sure, it's possible temporarily in the short term you might get worse, although generally that doesn't happen to most of our students if they follow our guidelines. It does happen about 5% of them or less, but it is possible. In other words, if I get a student who says, I'm not willing to take any risk whatsoever of getting worse, I won't work with them on any fundamental change. Mm. I'll work with them on Band-Aids, mm-hmm. but I won't work on a major change in their golf swing.
And it's a huge commitment. I mean, it's like, don't forget, we have a life going on. Golf is supposed to be recreation,
right,
for us. And that we have families and jobs and commitments and, you know, spouses who don't play and are not tolerant. So we cannot practice 3 to 5 times a week and then play twice a week.
So you got to find a practice plan that you can live with. And then you have to be willing to accept whatever level of consistency that smaller level of commitment to a practice plan will logically provide you. And that's partly the job of the teacher. The teacher has to be honest, I think, with the student and say, hey, you've got unrealistic expectations. Let's tone down your expectations for what consistency means from 10 fairways, from going from three fairways to 10. How about 3 fairways to 6? And with 6 fairways, we don't have to completely rebuild your golf. We can just work on your balance and your tempo and your rhythm, which are easy to learn. They're not technical. There's very few illusions in those three areas. So it's, you know, you don't have to get a PhD in golf swing mechanics to understand what I'm going to be teaching you. You know, there are simple ways to get to a medium level of consistency. But you've got to do that. You've got to match what you can physically do in terms of your lifestyle, in terms of your time and your energy, with what your goals are. And that's an important thing.
Yeah, and I want to acknowledge that I say this thing about, you know, we have a life going on and stuff. We're not that dedicated to golf. But frankly, you and I are having a conversation, but there is an audience right now listening to this conversation. And the audience are the type of golfers that seek out this kind of content, that they're so dedicated to their game and they're so fascinated by this sport that they're searching for golf podcasts and they're listening to a golf podcast and they're subscribing. So they are dedicated. And I do recognize that, that it's not, you know, people who like, oh yeah, that's fun. No. These are people who really want to improve. They really want to change.
Right. Exactly.
And they really want to be enlightened about this game and learn as much as they can and increase their golf IQ.
Well, you know, and some of that comes down to prioritizing time and energy, which is one of the gates having to do with how to practice. There's a whole gate just for that. And again, there are rules that have been proven to work, and these rules have been discovered by great players, and even by some unknown, not so great amateur players. Who, you know, you might even know someone who went from like an 18 handicap to like an 8 handicap in one season.
Wow.
And maybe in the second season they go from an 8 to a 3. These guys do exist. I mean, every club has them.
Yeah, but I love the ones where I get emails saying, I found your show because I have dedicated myself. I'm an 18 handicap, and I'm going to be scratched by the end of next year. It's like...
It's possible, but not too likely.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is, there are, you know, this knowledge is there. And, what I think this book's going to be about is to provide some of the answers to people. Now, here's the irony, though. Just reading my book, if you read the chapter on how to practice effectively, right? And it says practice with a plan. So before you leave the house, write down on a 3x5 index card what drill you're going to do first, how many balls you're going to hit doing, say, a balance drill with your feet together, and then what are you going to do for the second drill? You're going to do a tempo drill for, you know, 30 balls, and then you stick to the plan. I mean, now you can go, okay, that sounds like a good idea, but if you don't actually do it, it's not going to help you. I mean, this gets back to the multiple personality thing. You've got to wake up, you've got to pick an intention, pick an action you're about to do, that you've committed to, and you got to do it. There's a big difference between fantasizing about doing it and not doing it versus fantasizing about doing it and then following through and actually doing it, right? So, and not just in terms of the level of execution either, even in terms of understanding. I mean, a lot of stuff I teach people, I'll just give you an example. One of my big principles in our golf schools, we talk about two majorly destructive natural impulses that every golfer suffers from, including tour pros, from varying degrees. One's called the manipulation impulse. The other's called the hit impulse. Hit impulse has to do with wrong understanding of power application on the downswing. Manipulation impulse has to do with wrong understanding of how to hit a golf ball straight. And so when you manipulate your club, you also manipulate your body parts. You typically have very slow tempo, way, way too tight a grip pressure. The club face goes from square to open during release, and you hit a typical shot that starts off to the right with some slice on, some fade on it. And you don't hit short, crooked shots to the right when you have a bad case of the manipulation impulse. So I got a close friend of mine who lives in Hawaii, who's been a student of mine for about 13 years now. He's pretty good player. He's about an 8 handicap. He's actually helped assist in some of our golf schools in Hawaii. He knows, he's read our manuals over. He's heard me. He's watched me teach for many, many years. He had a huge light bulb 2 weeks ago, one round of golf. He goes, I discovered something you never taught me before. He goes, I just have to just let go of control and just let the club do whatever the hell it wants to do and stop trying to steer it through impact. Now, of course, he's heard me say that literally hundreds of times. I said to him, well, I go, Abby, what the hell are you talking about? That's the manipulation impulse. Oh, no, it's something completely different. I go, no, it's not. It's exactly what I've been teaching you for 13 years. But, the student's mind has to be ready to hear the instruction, right?
Well, anybody who's a parent of someone who's been through teenage years or is a teenager – has probably had that experience where the kid comes home and has a mentor or a best friend or a coach, you know, in school sports and says, oh, my gosh, they told me to do this, or even a teacher, and they told me to do this, and I couldn't believe I've never heard that before. And you look at the kid like, I've been telling you that your whole life.
What are exactly?
Who are you?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't we live in the same? I've been telling you that every single day, and now you hear it. Yeah.
Exactly right. So that you know, you have to be ready to hear the information in terms of the content.
Right.
But in this, obviously, this book's going to have a lot of content for sure. But for me, it's more important to understand how does a good player think about how to practice? How does a good player think about how to learn? How does a good player think about how to score in terms of things like course management on the golf course? How does a good player think about how to control his or her emotions? Because believe me, good players all have anxiety. This idea people play golf, you know, top players are in bliss on the golf course is ridiculous. I mean, Mark Helkovecchia had a great quote in Golf Digest from, I think it was 2 years ago. He said, I'm the happiest guy in the world, except for the 5 hours a day when I'm on the golf course, when I'm miserable.
Hmm.
And people think, wait a minute, this guy's been on the tour for like, you know, 30-something years. He's won a couple of majors and, you know, won a whole bunch of times in the PGA Tour. Now he's on the senior tour. He's miserable because it's, you know, to play good golf well, there's always going to be some, particularly competitive golf, tournament golf, there's going to be some form of anxiety. The difference is, like I tell my students, there's good anxiety and there's bad anxiety.
Right.
This is one of the lessons,
absolutely.
Right? I mean, the good anxiety is I'm a little nervous about this shot because every good player knows they could miss it badly. They could shank it, right?
Sure.
And every good player knows that. But I also could hit the bat. I could hole it out from here. So what a good player does is they take anxiety and turn it into a positive by framing it like, watch how good I'm going to hit this thing, right?
Yeah.
And the average golfer will go, watch how many ways I'm going to screw this up.
You've been watching my game.
And they start from the same place. They have a little nervousness about the outcome of the shot, but the good player frames it in positive terms and the bad player frames it in negative terms. Which of course becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for the bad player, right? So,
yeah.
So that's part.
I was going to say that one of the common things that I see, emails coming to me, a common thread is taking. I'm a scratch golfer on the range, and I'm an 18 to a 22 on the course. How am I able? What is the key? What is the secret? How do I get through the gate of taking my game from the range out onto the golf course?
Yeah, that's one of the gates. That's
is it really?
I'm looking at my list here. That's gate 13.
Whoa.
The art of shot making. That's actually of I would say of all the stuff I teach, and I teach, as you know, the mental game and the physical game.
Absolutely.
And fitness.
Yeah.
That's my favorite topic. I think that it's sort of like what's going on between your ears from about 3 seconds before you start your takeaway until the finish of your golf swing, which is about 4.5 seconds of time duration, are the most important 4.5 seconds of your life in golf. Because that's the make or break time.
Hmm.
And it's not, again, not talked about much. There's some information out there, but not much. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. You know, if you watch the average player, most of the time when I do, particularly playing lessons, I mean, obviously it's also true somewhat in the range, but much more true in a golf course. People flinch.
Oh, yeah.
They flinch. You know, they don't flinch as much on the range as they do in the golf course, and they don't flinch at all when there's no ball there, when they're doing a practice swing, whether it's the range or the golf course, doesn't matter. No ball there, no possibility of failure. Ball there, possibility of failure. Possibility of failure in your mind, and particularly in your emotions, creates the flinch. So we do a whole day golf school called Rip It to the Target, which basically teaches people, well, several aspects of the mental game, but one of the biggest ones is how do you flinch-proof your golf swing? And that basically means it's the internal part of what's commonly referred to as the pre-shot routine. The pre-shot routine is sort of the little steps you go through, right? That's the outer form, the outer structure of the routine, which is important for sure. You have to have that. But you also have to have the inner part, which is how do you focus your mind? Where should you focus your mind? What are the list of acceptable focal points that will create a good golf shot versus what is the list of ineffective, unacceptable focal points that will create a flinch and therefore a bad shot? So, for example, Never focus on the ball. Bad focal point. You'll flinch. Never focus on the club head. When I say focus, I mean don't try to picture in your mind where the club head is. That's the manipulation impulse. Never focus on impact. Well, now, there are some exceptions to that, but it tends to be for good players. So I would say if you're about a 12 handicap or higher, never focus on impact. Because, again, it'll activate both the hit impulse and the manipulation impulse. Don't focus on what other people are thinking of you as you're about to hit the shot, right? Don't step outside yourself into third-person perspective and watch yourself screw it up. That's performance anxiety, right? Don't think about the fact you triple bogeyed the last hole. Why are you thinking about that? That was 10 minutes ago. You're supposed to be in the moment creating this shot right now in the moment, right? So that's a big issue. And so I get these guys all the time who take the school, and they're awesome on the range. They're like 5 handicaps on the range, and they're 15s on the golf course.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the main – there's also things like not understanding course management principles. Mm-hmm.
So important.
You know, not working enough on their putting game and their short game because they spend all the time hitting full shots on the range. They don't practice their short game putting. But I would say the number one thing is they don't have control over their mind during that 4.5 second time duration. And good players do.
I can't believe how lucky I am that 6 years ago when I was really – I'd never done this before. I really had never done golf interviews or anything like that. And I wasn't – my thought was to talk about golf courses – that I came up with this name, Golf Smarter.
I love it. I love it.
It's like, oh my gosh, it's so much bigger than I ever thought it was.
Well, and you got pretty good right away when you dropped all the mechanical swing thought stuff and just started playing more strategy golf, right?
Mechanics? Not my favorite topic.
But wasn't that your big breakthrough though? Was you just sort of went out and said, I'm just going to trust my swing and pick a target and hit it there and go find it and hit it again, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And not
beat
myself up over the result.
Right. So you went through that gate. Now, did you go through that gate on your own, or did someone advise you to do that?
Oh, come on. This is episode number 260-something. I mean, how many interviews? And, I've talked to you. This is our third or fourth show together, right?
Right.
And I think there's a couple people, a small handful of people that I've had on the show more than 3 or 4 times. So that means I've talked to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And they're bombarding me with their theories on what to do. And it's not just swing mechanics. It's fitness. It's, it's putting. It's short game. It's, mental game. I've been very lucky to be able to talk to so many different people. And there's no possible way I can absorb it. I mean, I've talked to listeners who said, remember that time you said blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, are you kidding? I have no idea. No, I don't listen to this show. I'm just having conversations. You get to listen to it. No, there's no way I absorb all this stuff. So I don't know where it came from. Not a clue. So where's the rider block, man? I mean, you seem to have this stuff in order. You know which gates are which. You've clearly thought about it. When is this book happening? Where are we with this?
With this one?
Yeah, I mean,
this one's kind of. I have a feeling because all I'm doing now is finishing up the actual outline as to what's. I'm sort of editing. I'm sort of doing the editing, some of the editing in advance. Because I told myself it's going to be 3 to 6 sort of lessons or rules for each category of the 15 categories.
Okay. Yeah.
But the writing part will happen. I think it's going to write itself, but that's my feeling. The other two, the writer's block on the other two is because
the other two books or the other two concepts?
The other two books is where I have the writer's block.
Yeah. I mean, this is an encyclopedia you've got going on here.
Yeah.
This is a lot of content.
Well, I'm hoping it's not going to – the irony is I'm hoping – it sounds like it's going to be a long book. 15 gates is a lot of gates, right?
Yeah.
I could have 5 gates and probably sold more books, but because people want simplistic information. But believe me, it didn't start out – if it started out at 25 gates, I had to bring it down to 15. But
wow.
But
why not make it 18? Why not? I mean, come on. This is golf. Why not just make it 18?
What I'm trying to do is say – I'm thinking of all these students I worked with over the years and my own struggles too. I've walked through all 15 of these gates, so I know from firsthand experience what each gate is like. But each gate represents a golfer's internal struggle with some aspect of the game. Mm. I'll just give you an example. So for me, until – I had a crisis in my putting game 5 years ago. I was always a really good putter, particularly in medium length putts and long putts. Not so great on short putts of around 5 or 6 feet or less, but, you know, good, decent, right? And then 5 years ago, I had a round of golf at the Palmer course at Turtle Bay in Oahu. I had never played the Palmer course before. And they have a very unique type of grass called Paspalum Bermuda, which is sort of not as slow or grainy as traditional Bermuda. So it's faster and doesn't you know, and it has less of a – the grain has less of an effect on the curvature of your putt than traditional Bermuda. But not as – but less so than – you know, not as fast as, say, a bent grass or a Poiana green. So I've got, you know, 50 years of golf, all this – you know, years and years of putting on certain greens. And I got two different distance controls. I got bent grass distance control when I'm in the mainland. I got traditional Hawaiian Bermuda. I got that distance control. Anyhow,
wow.
I shot 81. Get that. I had 81, so good ball striking round, 9 3-putt greens. This is from a guy who would average around 1 3-putt a round on a course that I had played, you know, was semi-familiar with, maybe 2 3-putts the first time I played a new course. And no 3-putts on a course I play a lot. 9. So it was just awful. And it was because...
And let that be a lesson to people. Let that alone be a lesson.
Yeah. Because after my 3rd 3-putt, now I had the yips. On the 3rd 3-putt, I mean, I was putting from 30 feet. I was putting it, you know, either 10 feet short or 10 feet by. I had no distance control. Anyhow, so what that did is it was a struggle for me because now I had to go back and think, well, wait a minute. Putting was always something I could always do well since I was a kid. My dad was a really good putter. It was always easy for me. Now I know what my students go through when they're struggling with the putting yips, right? And it wasn't a bad case of the yips. I fixed it in about a little less than a year, but it was a mild case of the yips. And now I'm putting better than I ever did. So I actually learned more about putting and know way more now about putting than I did 5 years ago. Even though I was doing putting schools, you know, 8, 9, 10 years ago, very successfully. People said it was the best putting school they've ever been to. I learned so much more because I had to go back and relearn the art of putting and the science of putting. So that's one of the gates. Putting is one of the gates.
Oh, yeah. Well, it also substantiates my thought that you learn so much more from failure than you do from success.
Oh, no question. Ask Tiger about that from the last year.
Well, yeah.
He said that at his press conference last week when he lost in the playoff to Graham McDowell. He said, it's been an interesting year, but I've learned more in this last year than every other year in my life.
Wow.
And he said, obviously I learned more about my personal life, but also he goes, I also learned more about golf in the last year. His worst year ever by far since he took up the game. Literally, the worst year.
Yeah.
Didn't win a single tournament all year. That's never happened to Tiger.
Right,
every year
right.
He started playing golf, he's won multiple
came
times.
Close, especially on that last one, the last day, McDowell beat
exactly.
him.
Oh. Yeah. Oh. But he said he learned more in the last year than all the previous years in golf because of my failures. So that's absolutely true. So
let's see what that translates to.
But the idea of the struggle is, I mean, you know, it's so cool when the gate finally opens.
Yeah.
It's such a rush of joy. You know, when you get through it. So, you know, anyhow, that's what the gate idea is.
And also, it's interesting when you talk about, you know, playing on a golf course where you're playing on a green that you've never played this kind of grass before. And I've got this theory that the USGA are advocates for the golf course, not the golfer.
Oh, it's interesting.
And that's why some of the rules are the way they are. And to me, it's part of the problem why there are more golfers leaving the game than starting it.
Mm-hmm.
It's because that the governing body is more concerned about the golf course.
Now, when you say the golf course, do you mean the physical condition or do you mean keeping it as tough as possible?
Uh-huh.
Or both.
keeping the game as hard as they can because it's really focused more on the elite players. It is an elite game. It's an elitist game. And it's focused more on that small number of really good players than the rest of us. And that's why people get so frustrated they walk away. What are the three biggest problems? It takes too long, it's too expensive,
right.
And it's too damn hard.
It's too hard, yeah.
Right. So the USGA is not going, you know what, we really have to change things around because we're losing bodies here. We need to, you know, this is a huge industry that we need to support and find ways of making more money. That's the point of an industry, right?
Right. Right, there's no question about it, yeah.
Right. And so, but no, the governing body is, nah, meh. You know, it's like the major that we had this year that was Whistling Straits, right? If it's sand, it's...
That ruling was insane. Right. I totally agree. Yeah.
If it's sand, it's a bunker. I don't care where it is.
In the gallery, you've got 500 people standing in the bunker? What does that have?
Right, exactly. You've got, you know, so it's like, come on. What about us?
I totally agree with you on that point. I mean, some of the rules are just really dumb.
Yeah. Well, you know.
You want to hear my favorite dumb rule? We talked about this before. You know, about 8 years ago, Jeff Maggart was leading the Masters. He led on Friday and Saturday. He had a two-shot lead starting on Sunday. And I think it was on like the 12th. No, it wasn't the 12th. It's a par 3. I think it was the 13th hole. He still had, I think, a one-shot lead. But he hit his drive into it. It's a short par 5, if I remember right, at Augusta. He hit his drive into a fairway bunker. And he was hitting an iron out. And he didn't pick a high – back to the course management thing. He didn't choose a club that had enough loft to guarantee getting over the lip. The ball hits the lip of the bunker, comes back, hits him in the groin. He falls down in agony in the bunker, screaming in agony, right? Two-stroke penalty. It's not enough that he practically sterilized himself, you know? It's the end of his sex life. That's over. He's got to get a two-stroke penalty. I think if
and he's
got to
call it on himself.
Bad enough to cause severe pain, I think you should get to deduct two strokes from your score.
And he's got to call it on himself.
Yeah, he's got to call it on himself. Yeah.
I mean, two strokes. Okay,
are you kidding me? And it cost him the Master. Then the rest of the round, he went downhill from there.
Yeah, I would think so. He could barely. And now he's like, somebody just pull up a golf cart here. I can't walk.
Yeah, poor Jeff. I mean, it was awful to watch.
Oh, ouch. Oh, man. So we have now been recording for about an hour and a half. And
all right, can I just say one more thing, or do we? No,
absolutely. Say what you got to say, because I was just about to say this is probably the longest period of time in about 10 years that I haven't gone to pee. So,
all right, I'm almost done. So one of the things I wanted to bring up, only because every year I ask myself, I ask the staff, I have four guys that work with me. Okay, what's the number one thing we did, or that we showed people, or you know, we taught people, or that they sort of got that really helped the average golfer in the past year? And this year, well, we ask it in two ways, in the mental game and in the mechanical game. 2 years running now, it's been the same answer, teaching people how important awareness of awareness is. We've had a lot of golfers, for example, a longtime student of mine went from, I think he started the year as like a, what was he, a 12 and a half, 13 handicap, and he finished as 9.0. So that was a good improvement for him. And I asked him, I go, what was the secret? He goes, oh, it was the whole question. It was awareness of awareness. Being aware of where my mind is awareness of awareness. If it's in the wrong place, stop putting it in the wrong place, put it in the right place, right? On the physical game, particularly in terms of the long game shots, so this also applies to short game shots as well, this will blow your average listener's mind. What most people don't realize is that the speed of your club head, the speed of your hands and arms, and the speed of your shoulder girdle, right? Particularly the right side of your shoulder girdle.
What's a shoulder girdle?
Well, the shoulder girdle is basically, it's your scapula and your clavicle system. So it's that, think of your spine as being the cross on a T,
mm-hmm.
and the horizontal bar at the top of the cross
right.
of a T, that's your shoulder girdle.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
So when you hit a golf shot, whether it's a short shot or long, doesn't matter, you wind up that tee, the horizontal bar moves in a circle 90 degrees to your spine, mm-hmm. right? To your right if you're a right-handed golfer. And then it unwinds, like unwinding a spring on the forward swing. And that's called the upper body pivot. There's also a mid-body pivot or core pivot, which is the lower spine in your belly. And there's a lower body pivot, which is how your hips work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you got three segments that rotate, your hips, your core, and your upper torso or shoulder girdle.
Okay.
So what people don't realize is, and if I could give people one thing to sort of ponder out there as a thought experiment, what good players do, and this has been absolutely proven a million different ways, some scientists have studied this, it's been you can prove it all kinds of ways with new technology, but the speed of your shoulder girdle, the speed of your hands, arms, same thing, right? Hands being the bottom of your arms, the speed of the club head all move at the same speed RPM-wise, meaning revolutions per minute. So the speed of the rotation on the downswing until just before impact, when the club head speeds up a tiny bit, but until just a fraction of a second before impact, they're all three moving at the same RPM speed. Now, people out there are listening are going, no way. How can that possibly be? Yeah. It's true. It's true, folks. Now, what the average golfer does is they try to make the club head move in a faster RPM speed than their hands. And the way they do that is they throw the club head sideways from their wrists, from the wrist joint, or we call that flipping, at some point in the downswing. If you do it really early, it's called early release. If you do it from the top of the backswing, right? They try to make their hands move past their body because they swing their arms sideways across their chest. Good players don't do that. In other words, the angle that the arms are to the chest and the angle that the club head is relative to the hands, those angles stay more or less the same until just after impact for a good player. And every Joe average out there is trying to throw the club head past their hands, trying to throw their hands past their spine, across the midline of their body before impact. And the pros don't do that. The pros try to keep all those angles intact and simply unwind their body.
Hmm. Wow.
Have you ever thought of it that way before?
No, of course not. That's amazing.
Yeah, because it doesn't look like when you watch a good player swing, what your eye is going to see is club head passing the hands, which does happen, but it happens way after impact. Arms passing the body, which does happen, but it happens way after impact. But because we can't see it due to the speed of the motion, there's an illusion created, and we see that those angles changing, which are happening well after impact, happening before and during impact. And so, therefore, that's what we try to do. Now, of course, if that's what your subconscious mind perceptual filter believes is reality, then that's what your body does. So when you have your local teaching pro say, hey, you're releasing your wrist cock angle too early, or you're losing connection of your upper arms against your chest way too early, you know, it's way before impact instead of way after impact, now you know why. Because that's what you see good players doing. They aren't doing it. If you watch super, super slow-mo, particularly high definition, particularly from an overhead camera view looking down on a good player, you can see that those angles stay intact. The club head doesn't pass the hands till after impact. The arms don't pass midline of the spine or the spine until after impact. And you look at a high handicap player, and those angles are changing way before impact, way before. So try to feel like your shoulder girdle, your hands, and the club are all moving at the same speed. Rotationally. Now they're going to move at different speeds, miles per hour, because the club head's the longer end of the lever, right? It's like if you have a phonograph record. Remember old 78 record?
Sure.
78 RPM, right?
It's on
the turntable, right? This is for us old fogies, right? Pre-digital age.
Yeah.
on your stereo, right?
Yeah.
But if the RPM speed of the edge of the record and the RPM speed at the center of the record are identical, 78 RPM. But the miles per hour of the center of the record is much slower than the miles per hour of the edge of the record, even though the RPM speed is the same. That's what I'm talking about.
That's a good example.
Yeah, we call it the MPH versus the RPM illusion. There's 30 sensory illusions we've identified in golf, and that's one of them. That has to do with tempo.
Fascinating. Yeah. Hey, thanks so much for getting the Skype headset this.
I'll send you the $37 bill from Amazon.
Are you kidding? I'm going to send you the bill for my time on this one. No, it's the longest show, I think, in the recorded history of this program. But boy, was it worth it. This was so much fun. So tell us your website address. And I guess that's the place to keep an eye on the progress of the book and when it's going to be available, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that plus the other two books, too. It's www.balancepointgolf.com.
And your schools?
Balance Point Golf Schools.
Yeah, this is – if you're in the Northwest or you're in Hawaii, definitely should be looking Jim up. Anywhere in the country or Asia, right? Because
we get more than half our people from around the country and even other countries. half from the Pacific Northwest, half from around the country.
And you can see why. I mean, yeah. you really have an amazing grasp of so many elements of golf. Integrated coaching. We've talked about this before. Phenomenal stuff, Jim. It's great to talk to you again, buddy.
Well, thank you, Fred. I really enjoyed being on your show. Have me on anytime you want. This is so much fun hanging out and talking with you.
Well, it really is fun to hang out and talk to you, not to me. But your schedule is such where it's not easy to get this much time with you.
This is the time, November, December. So those are my two sort of semi-down months. Yeah.
Well, then let's try to do it every year instead of waiting 2 years.
Let's do that. Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much, man.
All right. Thanks, Fred.
Wow, entertaining content is one thing, but knowledgeable content takes it to a whole different level. And to get one guy to provide both of those in two full episodes is a bonus for all of us. I hope you enjoyed spending that time with Jim Waldron as much as I have. I think this is the pattern of what's going to happen for our members-only shows. Not a lot of information on the head of the show. We're just going to go right into the conversation. It's actually the format that I love that the BS Report does. If you ever listen to Bill Simmons' podcast, he just goes right to it. But, you know, when you have ESPN taking care of things, it makes it a lot easier to do that. I have you guys taking care of things, and I appreciate that. Next week, we're going to talk to Marcus Zuazu. He's the head instructor at the Jim McClain Golf School in Mayacoba, Mexico. I played down there, and I told you this story before. And we'll go into it again. My machine didn't record, and so and the phone's ringing. I'll be back. Okay, I'm back. Don't you just hate it when you pick up the phone and it starts beeping like it's a fax machine, thinking this is a fax number? Ugh, I hate that. I just wanted to remind you that we have Facebook and we have Twitter, Golf Smarter, and we can communicate on that. And I have been getting requests to link in with people on LinkedIn, to friend people, to have a business connection. And I'm happy to do that. But don't write it to Fred at Golf Smarter Podcast. For some reason, LinkedIn doesn't recognize Fred at Golf Smarter. It does recognize Fred at smarterpodcasts.com or Fred at greencreative.com. Don't forget that E in Green Creative. And if you want to link to me there, go ahead and send it, and I'll bounce back to you. No problem at all. All right, so next week, Marcus Zuazu, Jim McClain Golf School in Mayacoba, Mexico. The full story when we come back with Marcus. So have a great week. I'll speak to you then. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.